Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
You are now listening to the Calcio Corner Podcast with your host, Raffaele.
What's good? This is indeed the Calcio Corner Podcast, where we cover all corners of Italian football and more. My name is Raffaele. I thank you for taking the time to listen to this, the 33rd episode of the Calcio Corner Podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Audioboom. You can follow my personal Twitter account. It is at Italiano Calcio. You can also follow the Twitter account for this podcast. It is at The Calcio Corner. Now, a little bit later on this episode, I will have Mark Donaldson on. He is the voice of Serie A on ESPN here in the United States. We will preview the upcoming Italian Super Cup game between Napoli and Juventus on Wednesday, and so much more. So you definitely want to stay tuned for that interview a little bit later on. So we will start off this 33rd episode of the podcast by talking about the recent Serie A action. Action-packed weekend from round 18. As always, we will use the good, the bad, and the ugly to examine it. Let's start off with the good. The big game this weekend was the Derby d'Italia, and Inter put on a great performance, beating their big rivals Juventus 2-0. I thought Antonio Conte put together a masterclass plan from a tactical standpoint, and his players went out there and executed it perfectly. I mean, both have to go hand in hand, right? You got to have your coach put together and design the right game plan and tactical plan. But you also then, at the end of the day, the players have to go execute it. You could come up with the most bulletproof plan, in your opinion, but unless the players execute it, it's worthless. And so kudos to Conte, kudos to his players. You could tell the plan was early and often that they were going to attack Gianluca Frabrota, who was playing on what was Juve's left side, but the right side for Inter. You know, let's be honest, it was the right decision. Attack Frabrota. He isn't at the level of Danilo, who was playing on the left side. So Conte, he wanted his team to attack Frabrota, who had to deal with Hakimi, which is not easy. We saw Nicola Barella, he would kind of tuck in and overload that right side along with Hakimi, and it was just too much for Juventus to handle, and they didn't really adjust early enough to deal with this. A few of the dangerous passes, if you recall, that came into the box for Inter, and particularly in that first half, it was on that right side of the field that, again, it's where they really identified as the weakness for Juve and what they decided to attack. Barella, he put in one heck of a performance, and not even just because he scored that goal. He was all over the field. He really showed off what makes him such a special talent and a complete player, a complete midfielder. No Juve midfielder was able to contain Barella. They really had no option for him. He was able to just kind of boss his way around there. Alessandro Bastoni, he put in a great performance defensively, anchor in that Inter back line. And if you did not see the pass, the assist he had on that Barella goal, check it out. It's on Twitter. It was a superb goal by him. Just a lovely ball. Romelu Lukaku, he played well. He gave a lot of trouble to Chiellini, to Bonucci with his physicality and his just relentless effort and motor. It was something that, you know, Chiellini, again, just kind of coming back from injury, doesn't necessarily have his full legs underneath him, and to deal with a player like Lukaku was not easy. I thought Inter just controlled this game from start to finish, really, and given the form they were in coming in, you know, they were coming off some poor results, the loss against Sampdoria, the late draw against Roma. This really was a great performance for Inter, and something that I wasn't fully expecting to see them do. Given that recent form, I thought it was a statement win for the Nerazzurri, and in my opinion, it was perhaps one of their best performances, not just this season, but even dating back to last season. Ever since Conte took over, I think, you know, this was a Conte-type win. They got the lead. They identified the weakness on Juventus. They attacked it early and often. They played tactically. They played a complete game on all facets of the game. The strikers, the midfield, the defensive unit all played well. Handanovic did pretty good when he was called upon, the few times he was called upon, but he did his job. Just a totally complete performance from Inter. And again, one of their best performances, in my opinion, under Conte. Only thing that perhaps could have made this a better weekend for Inter was if Milan dropped points against Cagliari, but they won. So Milan do maintain their 3-point lead over Inter, but that should not rain on Inter's parade. Big win over their rivals Juve. For Juventus, I'm not overly surprised that they struggled in this game and lost, to be honest with you. Did I think they would look this bad? No, I didn't expect Juventus to look this bad, but I'm not surprised they lost. This was a game I felt that Juventus needed to win much more than Inter. I mean, a draw would have been whatever, kind of a so-so result for each team, and I'm sure the result that Milan wanted. But I felt that if one of these teams couldn't afford to lose this game, it was Juve. Obviously, a loss, you know, wouldn't have been good for Inter either. Obviously, a loss is never good for any team. It doesn't matter where you are in the standings. But this loss for Juventus, I feel, could prove to be more crippling than had Inter lost. Juventus, they managed just 4 shots on goal in this game, and not one player really stepped up for the Bianconeri. Cristiano Ronaldo, he never could get in a rhythm. No one offensively could get into a rhythm, and you always kind of expect, right, a player like Ronaldo to step up because he, you know, he's done it time after time over his career, not just at Juve, but over his overall career. You expected him to do something, and as I'm watching this game, I'm just, you know, I'm waiting for him to provide that moment of brilliance, and it just never came. Inter totally neutralized arguably the best player in the world. This may have been, you know, one of the worst games that I've seen Ronaldo play since he joined Juventus. He was such a non-factor in this game. I never saw him taken out of a game the way he was against Inter. I mentioned it on Twitter as well before the game that, you know, this was perhaps a great opportunity for Federico Chiesa to, you know, have that big Juventus moment and leave his mark in this historic rival against Inter. He had entered this game in really good form, so you kind of thought maybe he was ripe for this opportunity, but, you know, he didn't do anything either. As I said, no one did anything. I know they were without Dybala due to an injury, and even though Dybala hasn't been Dybala this season, he had been playing better over the past few games since 2021 has begun, so they certainly missed his presence. Another player that I thought Juve were missing was Weston McKennie, who couldn't start given his injury that he picked up in the last game. When he came on in the second half, he did play well. He provided a little spark for Juve, and, you know, Gazzetta dello Sport actually rated him as Juve's top player in this game. They gave him a 6 overall, so that kind of tells you everything you need to know about how this side played in this one. It's kind of amazing how critical of a player Weston McKennie has become for Juventus, and I know I never expected it to happen, you know, this soon, or I didn't know he would become this critical of a player for Juve ever, let alone this soon. And, you know, perhaps had he been out there from the start, maybe he could have been a player that could have dealt with Barella a little bit, but they certainly miss his presence from the kickoff. Juventus, they've looked better in 2021, but I've been saying it forever now. You know this if you've been listening to the podcast. Juventus this season, they just have not looked like Juventus, certainly the one we've become accustomed to in the past few years. I'm not going to, you know, relive all these poor results that they've had this season, but believe me, I think people still consider them Scudetto favorites because they are Juventus. They deserve some leeway. Their track record speaks for itself. But, you know, if this was a different team other than Juve that had the same run results that they had, that has, you know, performed the way that they have, I don't think people would be considering them in the mix for the Scudetto. You know, credit to Inter, credit to Conte, credit to those players. Outstanding game, big win. And you know, a win that I think mentally, you know, provides that little uplift that Inter needed given, you know, they have dropped points over the last few games. How could Lazio, you know, not be mentioned among the good from this past weekend? They won the Derby delle Capitale on Friday. That was the first game from this round. They beat Roma 3-0. They totally outplayed Roma in this one, and I was surprised how bad they were able to make what has been a good Roma side look. I'm sure the Friedkins were not happy with this game, you know, the way it played out, given this was their first ever Derby delle Capitale as the new owners. But, you know, back to the good aspect, a few players that definitely deserve a shout out on Lazio, certainly Luis Alberto. He's one of those players worthy of it. He scored 2 goals. He played a really good game. He's just becoming such a magical player in Serie A. You know, we know how important and how vital Ciro Immobile is. He's their leading striker, their leading goal scorer and whatnot. But you could certainly make the argument that Luis Alberto is kind of the pulse of this team and makes everything go for this Lazio side, and he showed it in this one. But also for me, the real standout was Manuel Lazzari. He deserves major credit for the great game he put in. He had 2 assists. He also had, you know, the hockey assist on that 3rd Lazio goal. He was outstanding. He was picking out passes when he was coming up and pushing forward. He loves to get forward, and he seemed to be hitting all the right passes and finding all those key passes. Really strong game for him. Simone Inzaghi, he, you know, put together a great performance from his game plan. Everything he pressed, all the buttons he pressed seemed to be the right ones. So kudos to him. It was almost very similar to what we saw Inter do to Juve. Just, you know, these were the two big games of the weekends, and both of them, in terms of like the big great battle on the field, we didn't see that in either game. Lazio totally outclassed Roma. You know, if Lazio lost this game, I mentioned it on the last episode, I think that it probably could have been their final hopes of getting into the top four. They could have kissed that goodbye had they lost, but they win. Do they have an uphill battle? Sure. But some results went their way this weekend, so they're certainly still in the mix. But a massive win against Roma, and again, similar to Inter, a type of win in a big game, big emotional game, that could help kind of, you know, build up those confidence and get you going on a strong run. In terms of the game itself, again, it lacked those fireworks that we're so used to seeing, especially in a Derby della Capitale. And a major reason why, obviously, there was no fans at the Olimpico. That certainly takes away some of the luster. But also, the game was never a competitive one. You know, Roma, those players were totally taken out of it. Lazio were pretty much on cruise control in the second half. It looked like the Roma players didn't even want to be out there anymore. But it still meant a lot to those Lazio players. You could see, you know, in the final minutes of the games, they were all, the players on the bench, they were all lined up on the sidelines, their arms, you know, all locked together. Even during a pandemic, they totally disregarded social distancing. They were celebrating and chanting, just waiting for that final whistle. And then when it finally came, they all rushed on the field and started, you know, celebrating. So it certainly means a lot to them, fans or no fans. It still means a lot. So like I said, you know, maybe this is, you know, a type of win that could propel Lazio onto a strong run and really thrust them back into the top four race. More good, Napoli, they absolutely dominated and just toyed with Fiorentina in their 6-0 win. You don't get a lot of those type of score lines in Serie A, but Napoli 6-0 in their victory. We'll talk a little bit about, you know, the La Viola end in a little bit. Let's focus on Napoli and the good. I talk about it on this podcast all the time. We don't know which version of Napoli is going to show up from game to game. It seems like a game of Russian roulette. Well, we got the very dominant one in this one, a nearly perfect version of Napoli in this game. Andrea Petagna did not score a goal, but he still played outstanding. He assisted one of Napoli's first two goals. He assisted on Napoli's first two goals, both of the first two goals. And I love the change in the variety and variance that he brings to Napoli's attack compared to when a Mertens is there or an Osimhen. Such a different physical player than those players size-wise, his style of play, his ability to play with his back to goal and just kind of make those little layoffs, which we saw him do in this game. Lorenzo Insigne, he had himself a great game as well. He scored on a penalty. He also had this masterclass assist on the Lozano goal, where it seemed like he took on half the Fiorentina team. He kind of danced around them and in and out of them, and they had no way to, they were almost like mesmerized by him. He delivered a perfect ball for the Lozano finish. And again, just Napoli, total dominant performance. And, you know, given this performance ahead of the Italian Super Cup on Wednesday against Juventus, has to give them some confidence in heading into that one, especially the way they saw Juve play, maybe boost their confidence a little bit more. Also, what was good for Napoli in this one, we saw Koulibaly and Diego Demme both return, not just return, but they also started in this game and both made an impact. Diego Demme, he scored a goal. They were certainly missing him in the midfield since he's been out. With Koulibaly back anchoring that Napoli defense, you could tell they were a bit more organized back there. I also thought, I know I'm very critical of David Ospina, but he actually had himself a really good game. He did make some saves because Fiorentina did have some opportunities in that first half, but weren't able to capitalize. Dries Mertens, he did come on in the second half for a little bit as well, so he made his return. You know, given teams like Roma, we saw them, we saw Juve, we saw Atalanta all drop points this weekend, it makes the win and the 3 points that much more critical that Napoli got. Even Lazio, I just mentioned, those 3 points for them are big as they're trying to fight for the top four spot. So it certainly gets tighter for Champions League contentions, but big win for Napoli. They also get three key players back from injury, so all is good in Naples right now. A funny thing from this game, you know, it seemed like after each goal Napoli scored, Gennaro Gattuso, he didn't smile, he didn't celebrate, he seemed to still be barking orders and coaching and getting in his players' face. If you saw the game on that first Napoli goal, he pulled Manolas over to the sidelines and he's like right in his face, like screaming at him, giving him orders, and it kind of looked like he was upset with him about something that Manolas had probably done a little before. So Gattuso, even with his team clicking and scoring these goals, and while the players are celebrating on the field, he's still barking orders, so, you know, It's that effort, it's that passion that he brings and the 100% commitment he brings from kickoff to the end of the game. It doesn't matter what the score is or whatnot. I think that's what makes him such a good coach and, more importantly, such a great leader of men. Some final goods from this weekend. Milan, they did win. They beat Cagliari 2-0. Not a surprise there, but what was good for them, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, he returned, made his first start for the Rossoneri in Serie A since November 22nd. He actually played the full 90 minutes, the full game, which I was a little surprised to see him do, but good for him that he was able to, you know, allow himself to play the full game. He scored both of the goals. One was a penalty. The other was a goal initially ruled offsides, but VAR ended up confirming it was a goal. So not only do Milan win, they get Zlatan back. He scores both goals. So, you know, how can any Rossoneri fans be upset? Milan, they've looked great, you know, without Zlatan. We know that. But now getting him back and seeing Zlatan just kind of picking up where he left off back in November makes his side so much more dangerous. Mario Mandzukic, he's on his way to officially signing with the Rossoneri as well. So he's going to help bolster their attack. And not to go off on a tangent, but you see a player like Mandzukic, he's joining Milan. We know Juventus are looking for another striker. There is history. Mandzukic obviously played at Juve. You wonder, how come Juve never explored that option? How come we never really heard Mandzukic linked to a Juventus return? Perhaps, you know, Mandzukic didn't want to return to Turin, but, you know, everything's clicking for Milan right now. They got healthy Zlatan back. Mandzukic is on their way. That attack could prove to be scary with Zlatan, with Mandzukic, with Rafael Leao. Ante Rebic will be on his way back from COVID, so all is good for Milan. Some more good from this weekend. Ernesto Torregrossa scoring the game winner for Sampdoria over Udinese. It was his Sampdoria debut. Torregrossa, he just had signed with Sampdoria earlier last week. He came over from Brescia, so coming up from Serie B back to Serie A. He came in on the second half. He scored in the 81st minute to get his new side the win. Torregrossa, he looked good, you know, when he came on. I thought he actually brought something different and some different life and a different look to this Sampdoria attack. Kind of like what I said, I like when Andrea Petagna comes on for Napoli. He gives them a variety and a different look. Same thing with what we saw from Torregrossa. You know, he kind of gives them a little different look than when Cagliarella is playing as their primary striker. And Cagliarella, he hasn't really played good in 2021. It hasn't clicked for him yet this year. Now, Torregrossa, he's not a pure number nine like Cagliarella. He's a little bit in between of a 9 and a 10, but again, he gives them a different look. I liked what I saw so far, so, you know, all's good so far between the marriage between Torregrossa and Sampdoria. They beat Udinese in this one. Udinese took the lead. They created some good chances between Kevin Lasagna and Rodrigo De Paul in that first half, but they came up short. Certainly a problem that they've been dealing with all season, coming up short. This is a much more talented team, this Udinese side, than their point total and their form would imply, which I'm sure has to be very frustrating for their side, but good for Sampdoria getting the win, and Torregrossa delivering the game winner in his Sampdoria debut. Final good, Crotone, they beat a very tricky Benevento side 4-1. They get a massive, massive 3 points as they try to fight off relegation. Unfortunately, though, they're still in last place with 12 points, even with those 3 points that they picked up this weekend, but it is a massive 3 points that should help them if they want to stay up in Serie A, although, unfortunately for Crotone, I don't think that's going to happen. All right, moving on to the bad from this weekend. Fiorentina, horrible weekend, really bad weekend. As I mentioned, they lost 6-0 to Napoli. Now, they did, as I said earlier, they did create a few chances in that first half, and Ospina had to make a few saves, and they were perhaps a bit unlucky to have not scored a goal, but despite that, they still get trounced 6-0. The second half, you could tell the players wanted nothing to do with it. They were just praying to God that all of a sudden that clock would read 90 minutes. Defensively, this side looked really, really poor against Napoli. They looked unorganized and really had no answer. One of the more unorganized and just kind of uninspired performance under Prandelli since he's took over. I thought at times Gaetano Castrovilli, he looked disinterested as well. He really wasn't moving around a lot. He wasn't trying to create things for Fiorentina. It wasn't attacking some empty space. He was kind of just walking around. We all kind of expected Castrovilli to take a big step forward this season, or at least, you know, us Azzurri fans were hoping that that would be the case. You know, he's a very exciting prospect. We're all hoping, you know, big things for him, especially with that Italy shirt. And, you know, he did start off this season really, really well. If you recall, he scored 4 goals over the first 5 games of the season. But since then, he hasn't even scored any. And not even so much the lack of goals, just his overall play, I feel like, has just dropped off as the season has gone on. And again, in this game, among many of the games I've watched this season for Fiorentina, this one stood out to me in terms of his level of disinterest, what it seemed like his level of disinterest from his body language on the field. You wonder if he'd benefit and really be able to display his full talents if he was able to play a bit more forward, perhaps more as a Trequartista. You know, perhaps Prandelli, he's got nothing to lose at this point. He'll tinker with his lineup and, you know, maybe push Castrovilli a bit more forward. So we'll see if they make that change. Some more bad from this weekend. Maxime Boussy, Parma's defender, he concedes a penalty against Sassuolo with just 1 minute left in the game. Juricic, he converted the penalty for Sassuolo, and they were able to steal a 1-1 draw. In this one, you can't concede a penalty with 1 minute left in the game if you're Maxime Boussie. You got to do a better job at staying on your feet. Parma, we know they've been horrible this season. They're trying to fight off relegation, and here you are just all but 60 seconds away from getting a massive 3 points against a good Sassuolo side that, you know, most picked you to lose against, including myself. Just a bad job there to, you know, cost your side 2 points when every point is going to be so critical for Parma. Even from a Sassuolo standpoint, they deserve to be mentioned as one of the bad things from this weekend. You're a side that's looking to challenge for Europa League spot, right? Those are some of your aspirations. And you can't handle a really bad and out-of-form Parma side at home. You know the last time Parma picked up a point, December 16th, they drew against Cagliari. They've lost 5 games in a row since then. And you couldn't beat them if you're Sassuolo. You absolutely lay an egg. It was really an uninspiring performance from Sassuolo. Francesco Caputo, he had a poor game. He didn't do much. So this game all around, plenty of bad things. I guess you could look at Parma getting a point, you know, as an important and a good thing for Parma. Because, again, I don't think any predicted them to even get a draw against Sassuolo. But when you consider they were just 60 seconds away from a win and getting 3 points, and they end up drawing, I guess you could look at it as a bad. Another bad from this weekend, Atalanta, they were unable to defeat Genoa at home in Bergamo. Similar situation to Sassuolo-Parma game. Here we have a much better side in Atalanta, dropping points to a much more inferior side in Genoa. Genoa actually outplayed Atalanta in the first half, and, you know, they didn't break in the second half. Certainly Atalanta put a little bit more pressure on in the final 45 minutes, but credit to Genoa, they did not break. When you consider the form Atalanta had been in coming into this game, they had won their last 3 games in a row, and not just winning them, they were demolishing their opponents. They won 5-1 against Sassuolo, they won 3-0 against Parma, they won 4-1 against Benevento. I expected to see a similar scoreline against Genoa and for them to easily handle this game and get the win. Instead, they end up drawing 0-0. This is only the 3rd game in Serie A this season that Atalanta have failed to score in. Obviously, no need to panic if you're Atalanta. You had some other results that worked out in your favor. Some teams dropping points. You got the 1 point, but you saw Roma drop points. You saw Juve drop points and get none. So certainly, they're right there in the mix for a Champions League spot. But no doubt, they are worthy of being mentioned among the bats from this weekend in Serie A because they were unable to beat a poor Genoa side. Moving on to the ugly from this past week, and I have one ugly. How about Ibanez? Horrible game for Ibanez, the Roma defender, who has been, you know, he's had a good solid season, the young 22-year-old Brazilian. He's done a pretty good job for Roma in playing in their back three, but he had an absolutely forgettable and disastrous game in the Derby della Capitale. He gifted Ciro Immobile that first goal, and on Lazio's second goal that was scored by Luis Alberto, he struggled to track down the ball. He was in a foot race with Lazzari, and he fell. He actually almost ended up committing a penalty, but Lazzari was able to lay off the ball for Luis Alberto, and he scored there to make it 2-0. Really bad game, critical mistakes for the young Brazilian defender, and you wonder, in such a big game like this, and the Rome Derby we're talking about here, in a game that Roma just got absolutely embarrassed in, you wonder how Ibanez is going to kind of get up from this. I read today in the Italian media that there were some threats on him and his family from Roma fans. Obviously, we're talking about some extreme Roma fans here, but he did have a disastrous game in a big game, and when you kind of compound that with how bad Roma played, you know, it just makes it look bad, and you feel bad for a kid like Ibanez because he probably after that game was totally distraught. He knows that his mistakes led to those first 2 goals for Lazio, and his side was never able to recover from it. So unfortunately, Ibanez lands as my ugly from this past weekend. So I'm going to have Mark Donaldson on. He does an outstanding job as the play-by-play announcer for Serie A on ESPN. You can hear him every weekend, whether it's on one of the main stations of ESPN or ESPN+. We're going to preview the upcoming Italian Super Cup. We're going to talk broadcasting, Serie A, and much more. So you definitely want to stay tuned for this interview. So let me welcome in my guest on the Calcio Corner podcast, Mr. Mark Donaldson. How are you doing today, Mark?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. First, I got to say, I truly appreciate the great job you do calling Serie A games each week, along with Matteo Bonetti. And I'm part of that group that wakes up at 6:30 a.m. for the games that you call. I'm part of that group.
What's your secret for waking up early? Because it is a struggle. But I suppose when your team is playing, I don't have a team. Bonetti can speak for himself. I don't have a team, but I don't know what you guys' secret is, because it's not easy. But then when you do something you love, whether it's watching your team or commentating on Calcio or football, I have no issue whatsoever setting those early alarms.
You know, I just, I don't know. I wake, I'm an early riser naturally, 5:36. It's, I can't sleep later than that. So it's, it works easy for me.
At least you're not on the West Coast. That must be tough.
No, I give those people credit. Yeah, so you had a really busy and exciting weekend in Serie A. You called the Derby delle Capitale, the Derby d'Italia, the Napoli-Fiorentina game. That was the early game. How much work goes into preparing, not just for like one game, but let alone when you have three games and three big games that you knew were going to draw like a lot of viewers? So how much work goes into that?
Yeah, I don't think about how important the game is or how many viewers it's got. Every single game gets the same attention from me. I think that's only fair. I don't believe in prepping more for an Inter against Juve game or a Lazio against Roma game than I would for a Frosinone-Empoli game, which we did last season on ESPN, and it ended up being a 3-3. Not a thriller, but it was a good game, and it was a 6:25 ESPN news game, so only the diehards were watching that. But it's like saying, I'm going to give 110% on the football pitch. I hate that. You can't give any more than 100%. You shouldn't give any less, but you can't give any more. So for me, a lot of prep goes into it. I can't speak for any other commentator. I do about a day's worth of prep per game that I do. It's rare that I do three games on a weekend. I love it when I do, don't get me wrong. So my prep for those three games actually began last Monday, the day after I had done the previous game, which I think was Parma and their game when they lost at home. I believe that was the game. We do so many. And the difficulty that you can have is when you've got to prepare for three matches, you can get them muddled up a little bit and mixed up a little bit, especially with games that are coming up where the teams might be playing. So I think it's important just to focus on one game. I take one game per day. If I've got one game at the weekend, then I'll probably start on a Thursday. But with the three, I started on the Monday, and it gave me time to watch other games as well on ESPN Plus.
Yeah, no, it's you guys do an outstanding job. And for me, a diehard Serie A fan, the ESPN Plus app is a dream come true. Ever since it came out, I'm in love with it.
Yeah, well, sorry, before your next question, one of the interesting things is, one of the things that I've done for ESPN in the decade that I've been there, I've done a lot of other sports. I've done tennis. I've got a baseball show. I've done golf as well. But with tennis and golf, what we have done over the last decade is we've provided content for what's known as the second screen. So at times, people have either got a multi-screen up or you've got something on your phone, something on your TV. What the second screen was for the tennis and is for the tennis and golf. For golf, it's featured holes or featured groups. For tennis, it's outside court matches. There's still an interest in them, maybe not as much as your main courts, but some people don't want to see all the stars all the time. They want to see what else is going on out there. So that's what we provided. And what I found while doing that was the people watching these, it's not a case of how many are watching. I don't care if it's one person or a million people watching. They deserve the kind of same respect. They've tuned in. They've given up their time to watch. But what I find is these people that watch, whether it's a second screen, whether it's a featured group, whether it's a match on an outside court, or whether it's a game on ESPN Plus that we're doing that maybe doesn't involve the big boys, the people watching that, they watch their team every single week. They're experts about their team. They watch their tennis player. They watch their golf player that they love every single week. So they know a lot about what's going on, and probably more than we know. So for me, the key is know what you don't know. Don't try and be smart. Don't try and throw in something and hope you don't get caught out and hope no one was listening to it. Just that's why you do your prep. And I think it goes hand in hand. Give the people who are watching the respect that they deserve, because more often than not, they're going to know more than you about their team because they watch every second of every game.
Yeah, well said. And you could tell listening to your broadcast that you do your homework. And even for those quote unquote smaller games, if you will, against the without the big boys, you definitely have your notes and your homework done because you're always well prepared. So you called, as we said, the Inter-Juve game yesterday. Was this more a factor of Inter executing their game plan perfectly, or do you think Juventus played poorly? What were your thoughts on the game?
I thought Inter were outstanding. I've seen them good this season. I've seen them bad, and I've seen them indifferent. I just thought they strangled the life out of Juventus. They won the key battles. And Matteo and I spoke about the battles at the start of the game. Where will the match be won and lost? It's not ideal for Juve to be without the players that they're without. It was similar when Milan played against Juventus without so many key players of their own. And Juve, who I thought were excellent that day, two or three weeks ago. And Milan struggled. Juve struggled a bit yesterday as well. The good thing from my perspective is I come at this without a team. I don't have an Italian team. I just love Calcio. I love Italian football. So I'd like to think there's a perspective of kind of neutrality, because I don't have any leanings towards any team. Right. And I just saw I saw a game whereby the key players played well for Inter. Barella was outstanding. I think I said near the end about the three players that I thought would be contesting for the man of the match. Barella and Bastoni were two of them. And Ronaldo didn't get involved. He looked frustrated. And that would be a lesson for me going forward for opposing managers. It's difficult to stop Juventus, but if you can, they're used to success and they get frustrated, especially Ronaldo. If he doesn't get his own way, he goes in the huff. We all do. It's human nature. Try not let him get his own way. You allow Ronaldo to get his own way, he'll destroy you. We've seen that so far. So Inter did two things really well. They nullified Juventus, and they also took care of their own game. And I thought he got it absolutely spot on with the way he lined up. He identified Frabotta as an issue that he could exploit. Aaron Ramsey kind of playing left midfield, but tucking in. So there's the gap. Hakimi is able to exploit it. So Juve will have better days, but they've had a few of those days this season. They got away with a lot of them. They've drawn a few others, but they could have lost by more in that game in the Derby d'Italia.
Yeah, no, I agree. They definitely exposed Frabotta. And you mentioned that Juve, they've had some questionable results losing to Fiorentina. They drew against Crotone and Benevento. Do you think people still maybe are just giving Juve too much credit and mentioning them amongst the Scudetto contenders just because they are Juventus? Like if this was, I don't know, Roma or Napoli, we maybe would have already written them off. But do you think people are just giving them too much credit because they are Juve?
No. And here's why. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Roma, Napoli, they've not won 9 titles in a row. That earns you the respect. If Juventus were 15 points behind right now, compared to a team that is 15 points right now, well, closer to that, Hellas Verona or Sampdoria, you'd still think there's still a danger. And that's why I said in commentary when Lautaro missed and they had another couple of opportunities to extend their lead from 1-0 and they didn't take them. My team's Heart of Midlothian in Scotland. They're not one of the big boys. But I know when we play Rangers or Celtic and we don't take our chances, more often than not, it comes back to haunt you. And that would be my concern yesterday for Inter. And it didn't, because they kept their foot on the gas. And I mentioned about the UFC in commentary with Matteo. When you've got the opportunity to get your opponent out of there, to kill them off, to make sure they don't come back, you've got to take it. So Juventus having won 9 Scudetti in a row, I think they deserve a little bit more respect from people. And that takes me to a comment that I made yesterday with regards to Milan fans, who ideally would have wanted a draw yesterday, because that would have ensured both Inter and Juve wouldn't have got 3 points. But I think for them, having Inter level on points with them, and I know Milan and play later against Cagliari, and having Juventus 7 points behind, I still think Juve are a danger. And while a draw would have been the better result for Milan, I know they wouldn't have been cheering on Inter. However, Juventus still lurking. If they click like they did against Milan, then watch out. So the further away you can get away from them, the better. It's like being 20 meters or 20 yards away from the finishing line, but Usain Bolt is a further 20 yards back. There's still a chance. That's where Juve is right now. They're not at their best, but there's still a chance.
Right, the heart and fight of a champion, a team that's experienced and done it before. And you kind of mentioned...
They're the only ones that have done it as well. Right. I mean, I know Ibrahimovic did it with Milan under Allegri in 2011. But as a team, I mean, we've got a similar scenario. I say we, as in Scotland. I'm half Scottish, half American now, dual citizenship. But Rangers and Celtic right now, Rangers are trying to stop Celtic from doing 10 in a row. And they're now 20-odd points clear. But there's still that look over the shoulder. We're up against a team that knows how to get it done. And there's a saying, horses for courses. I like my horse racing. And if you've got a horse that's been over the course before, knows how to get it done, they always are dangerous. They might be a year older, and that's a concern, because you're not going to get a Scudetto, another one, with Chiellini and Bonucci at the back. That isn't working. And I'm just surprised they didn't go to three at the back quicker than they did. But there's still a danger, Juventus, even although they're 7 points, potentially 10 behind if Milan get 3 points at Calgary.
Right. No, it's fair. It's fair not to totally discredit them. So you're going to be the Italian Super Cup. It's on ESPN on Wednesday. Napoli-Juve. Napoli coming in with their outstanding performance against Fiorentina. Obviously, we've mentioned Juve coming off a disappointing loss. What are you looking forward to in this game? And who do you think winning this trophy is more critical for?
I think it's a bigger game for Juventus. Mm-hmm. Because you'll know, and your listeners will know, what it's like in Italy and the press. I mean, look at social media when they caught a glimpse of Vidal kissing potentially the area of the badge, and he had to come out afterwards because that's what it is. Can you imagine Italian media if Napoli is able to beat Juventus again, like they did in the Coppa Italia final? So while it would be a big win for Napoli, I think it's more important that Juventus get the trophy just to give them a little bit of leeway, because Pirlo came out and said they couldn't have played any worse. This will show us what kind of response he can get from his team.
No, yeah, and I try to be as objective as possible, but I'm a Napoli fan, so I'm rooting for Napoli in this one. But I agree, it's critical for Juve. I think Pirlo, just to kind of jumpstart his coaching career, and like you said, it'd be nice to see how they respond from this big punch that they took. You've been covering Serie A for ESPN now for 3 years. Is there like a one game in particular that really sticks out to you, or was your favorite to call?
My first game for ESPN was in 2010. And I've been doing it for ESPN Domestic in this country this is my third year. It's my 11th season covering it for international, because we also got in the Caribbean, Australia, now in Africa, some in Asia as well. My first game was Crotone against Milan in September 2010. And I've kept the notes from every single game that I've got. And I mean, it's a meaningless game for even Milan fans will probably struggle to remember what the score was in that game. But for me, it meant a lot. And I've covered some wonderful games, some great comebacks, and some fabulous games. And there isn't one in particular. I'm lucky in doing what I do. I don't think it's a job. I think it's a hobby. As far as pinpointing specific games are concerned, when we got the chance to call the Roma-Juve game from Stadio Olimpico, that was definitely a highlight. I covered many games live in stadiums. All the games I did in Scotland and Europe were in stadiums. However, since we've come over here, because we do a lot of, or we did a lot of other leagues, German and Spanish, we were doing them on the same day. So you can't travel to games when you've got three in different countries on the same day. So Roma against Juve was very impressive at Stadio Olimpico. But that Crotone-Milan game in 2010, one of the first that I did, will always have a kind of special place in my heart. When I grew up watching Italian soccer, calcio on TV in the UK, we had a show called Gazzetta. And it was Channel 4, so it was domestic. So everyone got it. It was a Sunday afternoon, and it began in the early 90s, and it coincided with Gaza at Lazio. So unlike in NFL, where, again, Channel 4 broadcast that in the 80s, and I picked the Dolphins, and I'm still a big supporter to this day, I never did pick an Italian side. Because back in that days, or those days, Parma were so good to watch. It was the days of Zola and Nevio Scala, and these days, Lazio had some wonderful players. Paul Gascoigne, just being British, was someone that you always want your countrymen and countrywomen to do well when they go overseas, or I do. Right. So I never really had a team that I followed back then. The first kind of memory I have of watching an Italian team was 1984, when Roma played against Dundee United in the European Cup semi-final. Lost the first leg 2-0 at Tannadice up in Dundee, and then there was a fair bit of skullduggery going on with the referee and all sorts, and the two men, the coaching staff, Jim McLean and Walter Smith of Dundee United, were spat on by Roma. They won the second leg 3-0, and then it's funny the way football works, because the team that beat Roma in the final I ended up working with one of their players, Stevie Nicol, at Liverpool, and was lucky enough to write Stevie's book. And there's a whole chapter about Stevie and the Liverpool players preparing for that match. And Liverpool went to Israel on the piss and got drunk every day. And I believe the Roma players went to the Dolomites and kind of had this this kind of hardcore training session away from the public spotlight. And then Liverpool went and got the job done, and Stevie Nicol was the only player to miss a penalty. But while you remind him of that, he shows you his medal.
I just wanted to ask you one more thing. I know you you mentioned it, calling like the game at the Olympico and when you were in Scotland in person, and now calling it off a monitor. And I know like a lot of announcers here in the United States with the pandemic, whether it was baseball or basketball, they're calling it off a monitor. Mm-hmm. How difficult is it calling a game off the monitor?
It's water off a duck's back for me now. At the start, it was interesting. You've got to know what you don't know, and you can't guess. And we all screw up. It's human nature to make mistakes. Right. There's a couple of times that I've identified the wrong goal scorer, because 2021 right now is a lot easier to call games with HD and 4K in the studio than back in 2010 when we used to do Asian League and CONCACAF Champions League, and the picture was so grainy you couldn't even make out so you've just got to be generic. And there's certain little things, little hints and tips for people to kind of look for reactions or check boot colors to see who's got the ball. It's fine for me, but a couple of friends of mine who are commentators as well are used to going to the venues, are now having to do it either from home or from booths. Like, how do you do it like this? And because it takes them a little bit of time. You can only see, I can see what you can see on a TV. I can't see if an assistant's got his flag raised for offside and you can't see it, but you think it might be. One of the lines I would use in commentary is it's onside for now, to indicate that this might be coming back. And I can't see if the assistant has put his flag up or not. And a good example would be the Juventus goal yesterday that was chalked off. For offside, rightly so, but the ball was in the back of the net. Then the assistant on the far side put his flag up, but that's out of shot. We can't see that on our TV. So you look for the reaction of the player, because what you're finding now, a lot of players immediately when they score, if there's any dubiety, they'll look to the assistant.
Right.
So if you see that glance and then you see the expression change, then you can be a little bit more confident in your call. But just don't make the call if you're not sure. You can keep it as generic as you want. You don't have to name the goal scorer. And I think in this country, with some commentators, there's a case of, I do all this prep, so I'm going to make sure I get it all in. I do a day's worth of prep for each game. On the whole, I probably use 10% of that, and that's enough for me. But the other 90% are there if I have it. Because everyone's different. The way my approach is, a little bit more like John Champion. I let the game breathe a little bit. And Matteo's good at that as well. I'm not going to tell you what you see. There's one or two commentators over here that kind of give a radio commentary on TV. No, that's not for me. I can see it's a left foot strike. I can see it's someone who's gone into the box. There's certain things that you say that the viewer can see, but you don't need to say everything. And you don't need to use every bit of stat that you've used. It's there if you need it, not because you have to use it.
No, good advice. And you and Matteo do an outstanding job covering Serie A. I can't thank you enough, Mark, for taking the time to come on the Culture Corner podcast. I hope you stay safe and I'll continue listening and supporting your work.
Thank you. And hope you enjoy the Supercoppa on Wednesday, ESPN2 at 2:50, hence leaving a little late plug, if you'll allow me to do so.
No, of course. I'll definitely be tuned in. And thank you again.
Good man. Take care.
All right. Now on to Bide or Sell It, to cover some of the storylines and rumors that have been dominating the Italian media and the world of football. Let's get right into it. Number one. Bide or sell it, good move for Parma, who are closing in on signing Andrea Conti and Benatia to bolster their defense. I'm going to buy this one. I mean, how can you not? Parma, they're a floundering team this season and definitely can use help, reinforcements, and depth at all levels, whether it's attack, their midfield, or their defense. These are two experienced players that are familiar with Serie A. Yes, I know Andrea Conti has barely played this season at all. He never quite became that player we all expected him to become when he joined Milan from Atalanta, but certainly injuries played a big role in the reason why his career has not certainly continued on the arc that we expected. But he is a good player. He's a good wing back, a player that could get forward and certainly contribute in the offensive phase of the game, as well as contribute defensively. And as I mentioned, Parma could use help all over the field. So I do like the addition of Andrea Conte. They're expected to close a loan move with Milan. Perhaps by the time the next episode of the podcast comes out, the move could be official. Same thing with Benatia. Good player, veteran, experienced player, obviously in Serie A, won some Scudetti in titles with Juventus. He's a good leader. He's not going to really make silly mistakes. He's a reliable option in the back. Someone you can pair and trust with Bruno Alves. You have a very old pairing defensively back there between he and Alves. But again, he's a good player. He's been playing in the Middle East, so I don't know, you know, what level he's been at, where he's currently at in his career. But at least his resume speaks for itself. He's a good player, as I said, good leader as well to add to that locker room. So yeah, I have no problem with Parma, you know, looking to sign Conte and Benatia. Now we have to give Parma's owner, their new owner, Kyle Kraus, some credit. I know his team is struggling, so certainly Parma fans aren't going to be happy from that perspective, and certainly he's not either. But he has invested some money in this club. We saw in the summer mercato, he brought in several young players, and those are young players that are going to need time, and we can't totally write their story now, how the moves panned out, but he spent some money in the summer. Those young players are going to need some time to develop. But now that his team, you know, needs help to fight off relegation, because certainly staying up in Serie A is goal number one right now for Parma and for Roberto D'Aversa, who took over recently as their coach. So to help them fight off relegation, you're going to need some more experienced players. So I like that they're targeting Conte. I like that they're targeting Benatia. He's doing the right thing by bringing in these players. So let's, you know, again, on the field, they're struggling. They're not where Parma fans would like them to be in terms of where they are on the table. But let's give Kyle Kraus some credit. He's a very visible owner. He's at the stadium. He's involved with this club. He's active on social media, promoting and supporting the club. And you know, he's been honest with some things. So, you know, he's been doing a good job, I think, from an ownership standpoint. Bringing in these two players is just, you know, some more evidence of that. All right, number two, buy or sell it. Paulo Fonseca is in danger of being fired after Roma's disappointing loss against Lazio. I'm going to sell this one. Now, we talked about Roma's poor performance earlier in the podcast in the Derby della Capitale. And I've read in various places on in the Italian media that Paulo Fonseca's job could be in danger. Now, I'm not buying these rumors. Sure, it was a bad loss, and not even so much that they lost to Lazio, because we know Lazio are a good side, but it was how they lost. It was kind of a lifeless performance from Roma, no real fight from them. So disappointing that his players weren't up for the challenge and didn't really show that emotion that you'd want to see in such a big game. But regardless, no way you're firing Fonseca after this game. I get the magnitude of this game and what it means to Roma, what it means to the organization, what it means to their fans. And as I mentioned, I'm sure the Friedkins are not happy about this result one bit. But you can't be, you know, overreact to this. You can't run purely on emotion, especially when you're making such a significant decision like potentially changing the coach and direction of your organization and your club. Fonseca, he's done a good job with this team. They're in third place. They're in the Scudetto race. They're in the Champions League race. I mean, honestly, who had Roma in third place after 18 games in this season? I know we expected Roma to be a solid team, but I don't think many of us could have predicted at this point they'd be in third place. And, you know, they're right there for the Scudetto. Whether or not we actually think they would be able to do it, that's another thing, another thought. But they're in the race. They're in the thick of it. They're having a very strong season, and Fonseca deserves his fair share of credit for this. So, no, I'm definitely selling these rumors that he could be fired because of this loss to Lazio. Just not buying it at all. All right, final one. Number three, buy or sell it. Inter rumored to be changing their official name in March is a good move for the club. I'm going to buy this one. Personally, I'm more of a traditionalist, and sometimes I don't like to see things like this change. I like the history and to keep things the way they are. But remember, you know, Juventus, they changed their logo back in 2017. And at first, you know, when I first saw that logo, I think I had a similar reaction to many people. Didn't really like it. But, you know, as time goes on, the new logo, it's grown on me. It doesn't even faze me anymore. And obviously, you know, you get used to it and it becomes a non-issue. So anytime this happens, you know, time, as anything, as always, kind of heals everything, if you will. So Inter's official name is FC Internazionale Milano. Serie A fans, we obviously refer to them as simply Inter. People that are less familiar with Serie A, they may refer to them as Inter Milan. And it's being rumored in Gazzetta dello Sport that their new official name is going to be changed to Inter Milano. And again, I don't have any problem with this name change. We're still going to call them Inter. So nothing changes in that sense. We're not going to start calling them Inter Milano. I get it that that's their official name, or will be their official name according to this report, but we'll still call them Inter. They're also going to be getting a new logo design to go along with the new name, according to Gazzetta dello Sport. And the new logo will, you know, highlight the letters I and M, obviously, to emphasize their new name, Inter Milano. I'm not sure, you know, what the motives are behind the name change and the rebranding of the club. Perhaps, you know, given the financial impact that many clubs have felt, and in particular, we know the Suning Group has dealt with this as well. They're dealing with, you know, issues and some new laws that have been, you know, implemented in China that are hindering their ability to spend money on this club, which is why, you know, there are reports that they're out there seeking investments into the club to help raise capital. So could, you know, part of the motive behind the rebranding of this, of Inter, be, you know, to increase and drive merchandise sales, which will help bring in money? Perhaps. I wouldn't take it off the table. You know, who knows how long this rebranding process has been in the works? Is it something that kind of just spurred up over the past month or so because of the financial hit? Or there are some other motives? We don't know. Perhaps we'll find out in time. But again, I don't think, you know, the official name change is such a big deal, changing to Inter Milano. I think, you know, again, we're going to still call them Inter. What I do think for Inter fans will be really curious to see is what that new logo looks like, right? You know, that logo, that badge, that's what represents your club. It's how your club is recognized all around the world by football fans everywhere. You know, it's the image that tells people who you are. So I'm sure that, you know, that's what Inter fans perhaps are more worried and concerned about, or curious to see what it turns out to be. They're hoping it's an appealing logo. The name change is a non-factor, because again, we're still just going to refer to them as Inter. And I'd definitely love to hear from Inter fans, you know, what are your thoughts about the name change, the thoughts of changing the logo? What would you like to see? And of course, you could always hit me up on Twitter. Again, my handle is @ItalianoCalcio. I would love to know what you think about this. But again, even though I'm a traditionalist and I'd rather not see some of these things change, I'm all for it. I don't have a problem with it, especially if it's going to help Inter, you know, drive and increase merchandise sales to, you know, help bring in that revenue, especially given the financial difficulties many clubs are dealing with right now. So that will do it for the 33rd episode of the Calcio Corner podcast. I hope you have enjoyed it. A special thank you to Mark Donaldson for joining me on this episode and giving up his time. Once again, please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Audioboom. As always, feel free to leave a rating and comment. That would be greatly appreciated to help us grow our content. And until next time, guys, ciao.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Calcio Corner podcast with your host, Raffaele. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.